What are normal age-related changes? And so here are some examples of some normal changes. It will take you a little longer to retrieve information. So if you're trying to, say, think of somebody's name, that's going to take you a little bit longer. And if you think about it this way, if you think about your brain as sort of like a file clerk system, and there's so many files in there, as we age, one, the files are like building up and building up, so they're just harder to get to. But also, you know, there's a little bit of wear and tear. This happens to every body part. And this, the process by which, so the synapses, they're gonna fire a little bit more slowly. So all of this is gonna cause cause you to take a little bit longer to retrieve the info. Okay. So occasionally is the key word, forgetting names or appointments. This is normal. And if you're experiencing this, you might talk to your friends and see if they are also. And I think that you would find that a lot of people do have that issue. Some word finding trouble, so yeah. Occasionally not being able to find the right word.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Does that apply to just common words that you use every day, or is it just words that would be tougher to retrieve?
No, any word. So spoon. Spoon is, that is a word, you know, most of us, when I say spoon, but, you know, just it's, and you can describe it, you just can't get to it. And that, you know, but I think the key word here is occasionally. So it happens to you. Every so often that you're like, you know, the thing that you eat with, not, yeah. So that's the that's the key. And then temporarily misplacing your keys and wallet. I don't know, you know, how many people have in the past year, say, misplaced one of those two things. But did you have to have a new key made? Okay.
Is it normal to also often lose your train of thought?
Yeah, I mean that as long as if you lose it, you can at some point come back to it again, right? You're losing your train of thought, but usually if you can the longer to retrieve information, like you're waiting for it, something else like reminds you of it again, and you can get back to it. And again, keyword is occasionally, so not happening frequently. No. Okay, and then this is sort of just a summary of what I said there. So working memory, if you think about the temporary memory storage and retrieval system, that's working memory. Also known as recent memory. So what did I have for lunch today? I just ate lunch. I should be able to retrieve that memory. Learning new things, that's also working memory because you're imprinting something new, right? If you're, you know, going to a class and you're learning new information, being able to go back and retrieve that when prompted. But the key here is that, like any other body part, there is an overall slowing. So your brain, your mind, it slows down. It's incredibly frustrating. You don't want it to be happening, but it's normal.
Rebecca, what's working memory, when you say working memory?
Yeah, so that is the memory that you're creating on a day-to-day basis. Okay. So working memory, so this, you know, it's like the recent memory, like the now forward I'm creating memories and I'm able to retrieve those. It's like sort of the process.
Not a long-term storing memory, maybe.
No, not the long-time stored memory. Well, I think at this point we have to choose between the noise level and the heat. Any consensus here? We'll wait for that noise to go away. And if it doesn't, we'll do something about it. Okay, so here come, this is like when you have to be thinking about, okay, is this not normal, and should I be seeking some sort of diagnosis?
How important is it if you have, like, you find out about your limits and disabilities and such, before you recognize them, it seems like everybody else around you does. Is that normal?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Yeah, it's true, and that's a key difference. That's a key difference between what's normal and what you have to worry about. Okay? So one thing to ask yourself, are you still able to be independent in your daily activities? And this, when I say that, sort of barring like anything physical that happens to be going on with you, if you hurt yourself pretty badly and you can't get around, well, that's totally different than not being able to do the things that you're used to be doing on a day-to-day basis. If you are, the bill payer in your family, and suddenly you're having a lot of trouble doing this thing that you did every month or every week, then that's a problem, okay? Just trying to think of some other daily activities. Come on in.
Is this the memory?
It is, yeah. So there's actually a seat right up front, or there's a couple of scattered throughout as well.
Is there something I should
do? Yeah, let me get you here. No problem at all. So if you're used to cooking your meals, always have, and all of a sudden you're like not able to sequence things right, put them together in the right way, that's a problem. So these things that you're doing on a daily basis, a weekly basis, that are just normal, every day, they keep you independent, now you're needing more help doing those things, that's a pretty key signal to talk to your doctor about it. Okay, so like I said, memory loss comes with the territory in normal aging. And here's a key here. You might complain of memory loss, but you're pretty clear on the details, right? So like, I have a friend that told me that, you know, she went to church and she wanted to introduce one friend to another and forgot a name. And she was more like, so she was telling me the entire situation. So I thought to myself, no, you're probably okay, because you can describe this whole situation here, and you can describe every incident of your memory loss. That's a pretty good sign, is that when you're having memory loss, you're recognizing it for yourself. So. Here's Steve, what you were getting to. If you are more concerned about your own memory loss than the people around you, or your own cognition than the people around you, that's a good sign. If the people around you seem more concerned than you are, that means that there are things that you're not noticing that are completely, they're just gone from your memory, okay? So that's a reason to be concerned. If friends and family are noting to you, you know, you've done this, and you're really not picking up on that, I don't remember that. That could be a problem.
Rebecca?
Yes.
How about, let's say the other day I was talking on phone and somebody asked me a phone number. So I gave just first three digits and I couldn't remember, my mind went blank. Is that normal aging?
Yeah, I would say so. So you have all these phone numbers in your head, like this file clerk thing. The fact that you just told me about that incident sort of points out to that second bullet point where you're remembering these memory lapses, right?
And then I have to look at my iPad and see what's my phone number.
And that, you know, so there you go. That gives me another indication that you're like able to make a reasoning jump, that you're reasoning yourself to, okay, I've blanked out on this. By the way, I'm in my 30s and I have to look in my phone to find my phone number. There are just too many phone numbers to remember in life. So yeah, that to me, if you describe that to me, I would say that sounds normal. One thing I want to point out though is there's this, some of you may have picked this up, it's called the AD8. It's a clinical tool that it's like an informant interview. So you would give this to your closest family member, your closest friend, the person who's in your life the most, and they would fill it out. It has all sorts of questions on it related to cognition, and they would fill this out on your behalf, because this is if they're the ones noticing the changes in memory and the changes in cognition. And then, so they fill it out, and then you bring it to your doctor and say, there's a little reason to be concerned here. Okay, so you can grab one of those.
Friend to do.
Okay, and then if you're not getting lost in familiar places, you know, we all have our local towns, the places we know well. If you find yourself being very disoriented, very confused, in a place that you're really familiar with, that's a reason to be concerned. So you go into a place that you've been going for a long, long time, and suddenly it's like, ooh, where am I? Okay. Any questions about that? So, I would say, this is, you know, an argument that I make, and they write this right into the definition of dementia. The key difference between normal aging and dementia is impairment in daily functioning and independence. So you're losing a little bit of independence. So are we all clear on the difference between normal aging and what's, and now we'll move on to the statistics, the data.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
So in today's world where we have lots of technology, you can imagine making use of that technology to compensate for cognitive losses.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas without it, you might have difficulty being independent, but with it, you don't.
Right.
So does that mean that the definition of dementia is tied to this?
Could be. I mean, it's, so this is all kind of too new to have been studied yet, but it could be, and part of the dementia is not being able to really compensate in that way by learning a new task that you're, you know, by teaching yourself a new task to compensate. If you have dementia, that would be pretty hard to do. But I mean, if you're already familiar with the technology, then not so hard. But it is a good way, those technological advances are a great way to cope with early memory loss, for sure.
Yeah, if you were on yourself in a familiar place and didn't know where you were and you had to get home, you could ask your phone to take you home.
Yeah, and that's great. That is great as long as you know how to do that.
That's right.
Yeah. But learning sort of after the fact, if you've had some really significant, clinically significant memory loss, then it wouldn't help you. So just a few basic statistics about Alzheimer's disease. This is the most common cause of dementia, and we'll talk about in a few slides what is dementia versus what is Alzheimer's. So we'll get there. I've seen actually such a wide range of how many of the bucket of dementia, how many people have Alzheimer's disease. I've seen it even range like lower from like 45 to 80%. It's really quite a range. And I think there's a couple reasons for this. One, it's really hard to pinpoint a diagnosis and say this is most definitely Alzheimer's disease or this is most definitely vascular. But often people don't even receive a diagnosis. Or sometimes people get a diagnosis of dementia rather than a really specific one. And then, of course, there are mixed dementias, so that's kind of throwing that range off, too. But still the most common cause. So right now, 1 in 9 people age 65 and older have Alzheimer's disease. That is actually, that statistic has recently changed. It used to be 1 in 8 or 13%. So we're getting better here. But the flip side of that is there's I hate using this term, but the silver tsunami thing, where baby boomers are now falling into that 65 and older. So the raw numbers are actually going up, but the percentage is going down. And not sure why the percentage is going down. Could be some lifestyle improvements of the people that are living longer. Right now, more than 5.4 million people in the United States with Alzheimer's disease. It's a lot of people. And it's very very costly. And it has a really big impact on people. It is really, when you think about it, 5.4 million people, it's just a number. But when you think of all of the lives that are affected by that, it's so much greater than that number. Interestingly, and not very many people know this, because you associate Alzheimer's disease with being a disease of older people, but people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s can get Alzheimer's. It's pretty rare, and it's all of those cases are genetic. So those people that are going to be in their 30s and get Alzheimer's disease, they know it. They know it because everybody in their family has.
I have a question about that too. So there is a genetic component to Alzheimer's disease, is that what I'm hearing?
We'll get to that. There is a genetic risk, I'll put it that way, yeah. Okay, and like I said, this is growing just because of population growth. This is a growing issue. Any questions about statistics? Anything that you're interested in that I did not include?
You know, about the statistics, they said that people who are 85 plus, 50% of them will have, is it?
That's pretty close. It's like 45. I've seen 45-ish, but
that's,
yeah.
That's a little bit scary, you know. You don't know. It's like flipping a coin. You don't know if you're going to get it or not, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are risk factors, and we're going to get to that in a couple of slides. Part of it is a little bit flipping a coin, but a little bit you can have some influence on, too. And we're going to spend a lot of time about talking about the things that you can have influence on. So, what is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Okay, I often hear it being thrown around interchangeably, even by clinicians, people that are familiar with it. Another piece is. People will come up to me and be like, I don't have to worry. I wasn't told that I have Alzheimer's disease. I just have a little bit of dementia. Well, We'll talk more about that. What dementia is it's not a pinpointed diagnosis clinically, but it is a set of symptoms that include cognitive decline, okay? So I always think of dementia as like the umbrella, right? This is the umbrella term. It's a catch-all term that indicates progressive cognitive decline, okay? Of course, we already talked about that Alzheimer's disease is the most commonly diagnosed type of dementia. And getting this type of diagnosis, either dementia or Alzheimer's, it is when there are two or more cognitive symptoms that impair daily function. And the other piece of it is that it has to be progressive. Okay, so like by progressive, I mean sort of like a steady decline.
One question, does it tend to be a fast decline or is it a slow? I know that it has to be individual.
It is very individualized. It's based on the disease. It's based on the age of onset of the disease. There's so many, but if you think about a progression from like, you know, very early stage to very late, the average is probably about 10 years. In your very most typical, you know, most typical case, but you know, it's really all over the board. So even me, I feel a little guilty about telling you the average, but to me that seems slow and steady, but it's all relative to, you know.
Rebecca?
Yeah.
Is there any difference between dementia and depression, or is there any relationship there?
There's definitely a relationship in many ways. I'll give you the brief rundown, but we'll cover this in a couple different ways, is that having a history of major depression, especially a history of major depression that you have trouble treating, that increases your risk for developing Alzheimer's.
Because some of the symptoms are same, right? You can't take care of yourself, you forget things.
Yep. So that's the other piece of it, is that sometimes somebody who has depression can really think that they have dementia because the symptoms are so similar. So that's why treating depression, if you have it, is important in many ways, in many ways. And then the third piece of that is often when somebody has dementia, especially in the earlier stages, they get depression too, right? Because sort of goes with the territory of having a disease it's a devastating, grieving sort of loss. And there are lots of little pieces of dementia, like people who have dementia tend to isolate themselves socially a little more, and that can lead to depression. So there's such a strong link between the two. So let's talk about some types of dementia. We've talked a little bit about Alzheimer's disease. I'm going to talk more about it in just a little bit because that's the biggie. And when we talk about dementia, it's worth mentioning that all of the types of dementia, but worth really delving into Alzheimer's disease since it is the most common. So vascular dementia, that's just like it sounds, dementia caused by vascular issues. So if your blood is not getting enough nutrients, if your heart is not getting enough blood to the brain, that can cause dementia because your brain cells are then lacking the nutrients that they need to survive and they sort of die off. This often is caused by TIAs, mini strokes, and you'll see that the dementia affects certain parts of the brain. So you'll see a less global decline. It's more Wherever this has happened in your brain, that's where you see the decline. Yes?
When you say not enough blood to the brain, is that specifically the oxygen or just other
oxygen
nutrients?
And nutrients. So your brain cells need both oxygen and certain nutrients to survive. And if they're not getting those things, then they can suffer. They can die. Mixed dementia. So that is, and these are kind of in the order of most common, but that actually changes around too. So this is when there's a couple different types of dementia going on at the same time. Most common to see Alzheimer's disease mixed with vascular dementia. But you also see Parkinson's dementia mixed with vascular or Alzheimer's. You can see any number of mixed dementias. So there are a few different types of frontotemporal dementia. So that's a dementia that affects this area of the brain here, so the frontal lobe and the temporal lobes. There's the behavioral variant frontal temporal dementia. It tends to be a little bit earlier onset than Alzheimer's disease. And it really affects behavior in one of two ways. Either a person will sort of lose their judgment and just sort of act like the id, if you think of like the id, the ego. So, or the person will be completely apathetic, which can actually look a lot like depression, but like not care about anything at all. And then there's primary progressive aphasia, which is also a frontotemporal dementia, which is a loss of language ability. And this is, it's like big time loss of language ability. And then these two come up together because they're very similar in pathology. So Lewy body disease and Parkinson's dementia. In both cases, there are proteins called Lewy bodies that accumulate in the brain. And they block the function and brain cells start to die. The difference between the two is in Parkinson's dementia, the person has signs of what we know as traditional Parkinson's disease first, so motor impairment. Those symptoms come on first, and then cognitive symptoms come on later. In Lewy body disease, the cognitive symptoms come on first. With those two types of dementia, you're more likely to see hallucinations, major sleep disturbance. So they have some really specific sets of visuospatial, so like not knowing where your body ends sort of thing. So they have really more specific characteristics than Alzheimer's. So all of these ones that I talked about are the progressive and like dementias. Here are some other treatable causes. And not necessarily they're not causing dementia, but they're causing dementia symptoms. So they can sort of make you think, hey, I might have Alzheimer's here when you're just chronically stressed out. A couple of big ones that are treatable is like you could have a vitamin deficiency and it could seem like Alzheimer's disease. And then you go and you get your blood drawn and you find that your vitamin B12 levels are low, you know? And once you start supplementing, once you start supplementing with that, then all of the symptoms go away. So I just, by saying that, I want to highlight, it is so important if you're experiencing these symptoms to go to the doctor and get them treated. It's like, every time it starts, I'm just going to stand up and act like I'm going to the window.
It looks like they're about to cut the grass out there.
Medication side effects, you know, there are sedatives that we sometimes take to get a little more sleep. There are a lot of medications that can appear as the symptoms of dementia. So, you know, if you're going in with these memory complaints, take a list of your meds with you. Another thing that we do here is a brown bag medication review. We do it twice a year. And a pharmacist will come in here and sit down with you, and you bring in like all of your medications and say, here are the things I'm worried about. Here are all my medications. Do they have anything to do with any, you know, is there anything that's going on here? Infections, often urinary tract infections can lead to delirium, which here's the difference with dementia and delirium is that delirium, the onset is like that. Okay, it's like overnight. So you've got these symptoms of dementia, and it's pretty intense, and it's like all of a sudden. We already talked about how depression can mimic dementia, and of course chronic stress. I wanted to put pregnancy on there, but I didn't think anybody would identify with that.
Stress.
Yeah, that's right. Any questions about these?
Right.
Yeah, a couple. So, cool.
This is just a general question regarding all the dementia symptoms. I sense from the way you describe it that there's some of them that are cognitive, but others are physical, like brain tumor or blood vessels.
So in these ones, like the brain tumor, that is not a dementia. That's not a dementia, right? So that's not causing dementia. It's just it's causing symptoms that mimic dementia. So that's a little bit different. So when you think about dementia, it's like a progressive disease, and there's only a number of diseases that produce dementia. Brain tumor is not one of them. It just produces a lot of the same symptoms.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes?
You mentioned about urinary tract infections. How could that cause a problem?
It just, you know, I don't know the technicalities, the medical technicalities behind it, but it can cause delirium if left untreated. A lot of infections can do that.
Infection, you probably have a fever, you'll be dehydrated, all of these things infect your brain.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's the first thing they look for.
Yeah.
If you land in the ER with delirium.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, if you have delirium, most people, I think, if you have delirium, somebody ship you over to the ER really quickly because it's really clear that something's not right.
Depression.
Yes, sir.
Is it something that isn't maybe confusable with dementia, but can dementia cause depression?
Yes, yes.
Do you have a sense of how often?
Those statistics that I have heard are like 30 to 40%. I honestly think that's low. I would expect that a lot of people, especially in the early to mid stages of dementia, would be depressed. Any more questions before we move on? We'll look at the brain. Okay. So here is the big, beautiful brain. And it is such a complex, complex organ that I feel like even neurologists, if they can understand it, I'm just like, whoa. Because it is very complex. If you just look at the number of neurons, 100 billion neurons. So our big brains can't even understand how many 100 billion is. That is a lot of nerve cells, and they, you know, a lot of different functions too. A great many number of synapses, so that's like the connections between, so every nerve cell has different dendrites. They're little, like almost like little tails coming off of them and where they connect to others, so it's all, they're firing all over the place. Okay, I'm giving up on it. I'm shutting it. If anybody gets really, really hot, please tell me, and I'll try to adjust the heat, but I'm afraid that you can't hear me. You mind if I just, like, push this chair back?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, guys, for the interruption. I'm careful. I don't have that kind of power around here.
It doesn't look like they're mowing much. They're going over it, and you can't see the difference where they mowed and where they didn't mow.
All right. Is that one even open?
It is.
But I'm sorry if we're going to, like, steam you out of this room, but if... You needed your sauna for the day anyway.
The guys outside cut the grass on the other side of the building.
I don't think even Shizuko has that power.
I'll see.
Since we have the picture of the brain up here, and I'm sort of up anyway. So this structure right here is called the hippocampus. And that is where you often see the first signs of Alzheimer's disease. So this controls that short-term, the working memory that we talked about earlier. It has a lot to do with that structure right there. That's part of the limbic system. But then it, so, kind of starts there, and then you see it bleeding out into different areas of the brain.
And that's which one is Amy? Gila or something like that?
Amygdala. Yeah, so that is the one that can, so that's a little one.
Red one.
That one, this is like, it looks like a little kidney bean in there. That's the amygdala, and it's the fear response, the fight or flight sort of one, and it also controls a lot of the hormone excretion. Yeah.
Can an MRI show that Alzheimer's has started there in the hippocampus?
Not positive about that. But I think it can show other areas of the brain. But I'm not positive. I don't know all that much about, like, what an MRI can do exactly. But those brain pictures, if you see a picture of a normal brain, and then an Alzheimer's brain where it's been fairly advanced, you can actually see deterioration of, my guess is that since the hippocampus is, like, really specific and, like, pretty embedded into the brain, you can probably only see it on the cerebral cortex and the outer areas, but that is a total guess.
So what... Are there any modalities like that do show that somebody does have Alzheimer's?
we'll get to that.
Okay.
So, I mean, that is part of it, and that's part of the diagnostic process. I think it's a bunch of things kind of coming together to create a picture of, okay, this is Alzheimer's. So here's what we know happens in the brain of people who have Alzheimer's. And I want to highlight, we don't know how it really starts, but we know it has something to do with people who have Alzheimer's, because people who have Alzheimer's have these things called plaques and tangles in their brain. So the plaques, so here's the, sorry person that's viewing us from afar, but here's the normal brain, and these are the brain cells called neurons, and then here's Alzheimer's brain. And these are amyloid plaques, so that's a buildup of beta amyloid. It all kind of clumps together, and it's like outside of the cells, and it interferes with their function. And then the other one is called tau, another protein called tau. And tau protein holds up the structure of a cell. So it is involved in holding up the structure of a cell. And they start to sort of cave in on each other, these tau proteins, and it makes the cells sort of wither a little bit, and you can't then get the important nutrients and oxygen to your cells, and they end up dying off. So we've talked a little bit about this already, but when we talked about the difference between normal aging and what to worry about, but this is the official word from the Alzheimer's Association, gives you these 10 signs. I'm just going to go through them really quickly. So short-term memory loss. This is the one that we all associate with dementia, right? This is the one that we think of. And that's usually the first sign. Challenges with planning or solving problems. That really affects your ability to live independently, correct? If you can't, one, plan. So, and then solve the problem. So that, remember what you talked about, like being able to, if you have some sort of deficit, jump to a way of solving it. Difficulty completing familiar tasks. That's the day-to-day stuff again. Confusion with time or place. That's when you go to a familiar area and all of a sudden you just feel an overwhelming sense of confusion and disorientation. Like, whoa, where am I? And it kind of comes upon you suddenly.
Is that like driving? You come to a familiar intersection and you forget which way to turn.
Exactly. Trouble understanding visual images or spatial relationship. Have any of you done a cognitive test where you have to draw this clock, the clock draw test? And so that's sort of like that piece of it, the visual images, the spatial relationship. Where's the end of me? Where's the end of my car? New problems with words or speaking or writing. Again, I mean, there is some of this that's normal, right? Word dropping every now and then. But when it's getting more significant.
Totally misspelling a word and then what was that supposed to mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, I could see that. But I mean, again, is it happening a lot, or is it you just did it like once or a couple of times? Misplacing things and you can't retrace your steps. Okay, so we all talked about our keys. Sometimes it takes a little while to find those keys, but usually we find them. Usually. You know, sometimes we replace it, can't find a key for a very long time. But not being able to, like, even begin to think about where you started. Like, I know I had, the last time I had my keys was, you know, you're able to think about that. If you're not able to think about that and you're just like completely lost, can't retrace your steps at all, that's a warning sign. Poor judgment and not understanding social context. So that is, say, I know that it is springtime right now, so there's a certain type of outfit that I'm gonna wear, and I'm not gonna like put on my winter hat and scarf and coat at, when I go outside, just because I see them in the closet and that's what's available. Being socially appropriate, so saying appropriate things, I like see a chuckle out of the corner of my eye that I'm so curious about. But, you know, saying things, I've heard families get really hurt when somebody will say, just let, you know, some truth that's in their head spill out, and it's just like a hurtful thing. So that's sort of like socially inappropriate. Families do that to each other regardless, but generally not to strangers.
It's called bickering.
Withdrawing from work and then other social activities. So that could mean that you're noticing there's some deficits there and you're suddenly not comfortable in certain situations, or you know that you're not doing as well at work and so you're kind of stepping away from that a little bit. And then finally, changes in mood or personality.
I mean, somewhat that withdrawal makes sense to me, though. It doesn't seem like it's just sort of I get blamed for a hell of a lot of things nowadays, and I'm in charge of losing things.
Yes.
And every time something is put in the wrong place, back in the pantry.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things I don't remember happening at all.
Yeah, and so that's not helpful. That's not helpful that you're getting blamed all the time. And so I can see why, you know, it's not like anything, there's no blame or judgment in that. It's just, I mean, from my perspective, and withdrawing, and what you said is true. And then when you think about, like if you're having a language deficit, how can you carry on a conversation? You know, so it's almost like expected. It's just that we also want to avoid it.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I mean, you know, when you start annoying people because of your memory troubles, they're going to start dumping on you their frustrations with you. And once you start getting enough of that stuff, you say, hey, I'm backing off.
Yeah, and some people are just extraordinarily sensitive to that too. So they back off before anybody even judges, you know, or before anybody makes any comments. Yeah.
Just a couple other things to notice. I have a friend of mine has multiple sclerosis, and some of these things fit the pattern, the MS,
uh-huh.
You know, the plaque in the brain, some of these other activities. Another friend of mine has type 1 diabetes. He doesn't take his diabetic shots enough or eats wrong. He gets very lethargic, forgets where he puts stuff, forgets to show up appointments or shows up really late.
Mm-hmm.
I have low blood sugar, and if I overwork without enough sleep, I start slowing down and just keep on going or face time and say, what the hell am I doing this over again, you know?
Mm-hmm. Diabetes is a risk factor too for Alzheimer's.
Need diabetes in the family?
Type 2.
Not type 1.
Type 2. Okay, so if you're noticing any of these warning signs, if you come away from this talk, if you know a family member, and as you come away from this talk, here's how you go about getting a diagnosis. The first, well, we call this a diagnosis of elimination, by the way, because you need to be like, you cannot just look at a brain scan and say, that's Alzheimer's disease. It's impossible. So what we do is we try to pull away the things that it isn't. Okay. If we're finding out that it's, okay, not B12 deficiency, being treated for depression pretty successfully, not depression. So we do a diagnosis of elimination. And by we, I mean not me. And this is who I mean. Always wise to start with a primary care physician, because they can do a lot of these elimination pieces. And if they feel like, and they can even, certain types of primary care docs can make a diagnosis. So they'll do a full medical history. They'll look at your entire history. Hopefully they'll do some sort of informant interview or ask you to bring somebody in who can talk to them about their experience with your memory loss. They'll do the blood workup, urine test to get to those, whether it is a vitamin thing or a thyroid thing, they'll try to get to that way. Neurological exams are part of it to show any loss of cell, brain cell. And then neuropsychological exams, and what I mean by that are those, like, the battery of testing, like the clock draw, for example, and there's all sorts of, like, the remember five words thing.
The Montreal test.
The MoCA. That MoCA is one of them. That's the Montreal test. There's a whole bunch of different tests that can be used.
And there's a Quebec test.
Haven't heard of that one.
That was for the
room. What is the F before MRI?
I have no idea.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, that might be a typo.
Oh, okay.
Oh, functional. Thank you. Functional MRI. That could be. Yeah. I inherited these slides.
Okay. I have a question about the blood and urine tests. In my own experience, my neurologist did this. They can detect, I think it's little proteins in your spinal fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And if those are found, it's sort of like not a diagnosis of elimination. It's actually saying, hey, you got something here.
Yes. So in your cerebral spinal fluid, you can find, remember I talked about those plaques and the tangles? Well, there's either an excess or so everybody's cerebral spinal fluid has some of the beta amyloid protein, because your body gets rid of it naturally, and that's how it gets rid of it from your brain. So if there's like too much or too little, that can be an indication. But I wouldn't, you know, that's not an indication alone. All of these things, they need to be taken into like a big picture context. My guess is that they didn't just take your cerebral spinal fluid, but they also like asked you a bunch of questions, okay, maybe gave you a cognitive test. So, right.
Rebecca, have they come up with some genetic analysis? Like they say, if you have gene APOE4 or something like that?
Yeah.
How does that?
So that increases your risk. Uh-huh. That we'll get to that too. There are some genetics that are like genetic mutations that are the most, like, most definitely, if you have this genetic mutation, you will get Alzheimer's disease, and it will be early onset.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're like pretty close to where, yes, we're close to the risk factors anyway, so we're going to get to the genetic piece. Okay, actually, before I show that slide, you guys all have them anyway. I was gonna give you a pop quiz, but you know. So biggest risk factor, that's what I was gonna ask you. By far, age is the biggest risk factor. And if you look at incidence of Alzheimer's disease, that graph there by age, then it's clear as day. That age is most definitely the biggest risk factor. So family history. And so somebody the other day actually asked me when I was giving a similar talk, when I talk about family history and I talk about genetics, what's the difference there? So it's just that they've been studied as like clumps of families versus like actually looking at genetics and like doing a genetic makeup. So they've just been looked at differently. So in terms of family history, if you have a very direct relative, so a sister, a brother, or a parent who has Alzheimer's disease, that increases your risk by 2 to 3 times, okay? Now we'll talk about genetics. And I'm not gonna pretend to know all that much about genetics, but what I do know is there are some genes that call for increased production, overproduction of the precursor protein to that amyloid plaque that you saw, the plaques in the brain. That's a mutation. That's not like the normal genetic thing that people are gonna have. That's a mutation genetic, and people are, they're gonna know about it because this is where it's in the family already. You also see in Down syndrome, there's this genetic component. So most people who have Down syndrome, if they live long enough, they develop Alzheimer's disease. But besides that, the APOE4. So APOE4 is a gene, and it can occur on either one or two alleles. If you know genetics at all, okay. I don't either. I just know what I read about Alzheimer's. So this is a gene that increases your risk pretty significantly for Alzheimer's. I think only 10% of the population has it, and you either have one or two copies. If you have one copy, it increases your risks, you know, by a certain amount. If you have two copies, it increases your risk even more. The most it can increase your risk is something like 12 times, and that would be the two copy one. Okay. There's another range of APOE. I think there's APOE3, which actually lowers your risk. So you can have APOE 1, 2, 3, or 4. Some of them are neutral, one of them raises your risk, one of them lowers your risk. It seems to have a lot to do with your risk. Yes.
I don't know what that word is. Can you spell it?
Well, it's not. It stands for something longer, actually.
Well, I just wondered if it was how it's spelled.
So if you look this up, it has a very long name that I don't even attempt. But you can look that one up. Again, it's relatively rare to have it. 10% of the population have it. Head trauma puts you at risk. We know this.
Concussions.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Any sort of head trauma. And the reason that this is important, especially for older adults, is that another big risk as we grow older is falling, right? Mm-hmm. And a couple of tips on this one is, if you don't know whether you're at risk for falling, here at the Aging Resource Center, we do falls risk screening. And then after the screening, we try to slot you into the appropriate classes. So there are some good classes to address falls risk. And the other like quick tip I can give you is if you are ever in the process of falling, protect that really precious commodity that you have, okay? And then, of course, heart disease and high cholesterol. A lot of, like, the vascular issues put you at greater risk.
High How about epilepsy?
Not sure. I haven't heard of it, but. He asked about epilepsy, yeah.
So wait a second, I have a question too. So you say heart disease and high cholesterol increase your risk of Alzheimer's, and that's independent of the vascular dementia you mentioned earlier?
Yes, yes, interestingly enough, yes. Okay, so, yeah.
So is, are you referring there to heart disease, everything meaning even high blood pressure?
Yes, and we're gonna get to that and on the next slide. So there was a study that was published in a really esteemed journal in 2015 where they gave advice to primary care doctors about here are the risk factors that can be responsible for a certain percentage of the cases of Alzheimer's in this country. So,
I'm sorry, can you say it again?
Yeah, the risk factors that are modifiable, so you can change these things in yourself, that could be responsible for a certain percentage of Alzheimer's disease. So taking away the other risk factors like age, you can't control that, we all age. Taking away the genetic component, you can't control that either.
Like your parents.
Yeah, you can't control who your parents are. Here's what you can control. And these are listed in degree of seriousness. Or how much they are accountable for Alzheimer's disease. Okay. Number one, what a shocker, right? So here's the thing. The mantra sort of prevention with dementia is what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So if there's anything that your doctor has, Who hasn't had in their life been physical inactivity is something that I really need to address? Who in this room? Show me. it's so common, right? And it's really hard to stay on top of, but it makes so much difference.
I've heard that half of the blood in your body goes to the brain.
Mm-hmm. It does. Yeah. And when you think about your brain as this small 3 pounds, what percentage is 3 pounds of your body? And you think of all those neurons that your blood is feeding. So having good cardiovascular health is so important to the brain. It really is. Depression, we talked about depression a lot already. There's a pretty strong link. And treating depression is not always possible, but most of the time it is. And sometimes it's linked to that very first one in treating depression. So, at midlife, if you have high blood pressure, that puts you at risk. So controlling that, whatever way you need to control it, either through meds or through, changing your diet and exercise habits. Midlife obesity, smoking. That one probably shouldn't come as much of a surprise, right? Low educational attainment, that's interesting. My guess is that's a little bit of like a mix between really exercising your brain and creating more synapses and creating cognitive reserve, but I think that there might be some socioeconomic factors in there as well that are just, par for the course. And then again, diabetes. So managing your diabetes, if you have diabetes, is very important.
What about that cognitive reserve? That's the idea that if you have Alzheimer's, you're able to compensate for it in some terms?
Yep. The idea of cognitive reserve is you're exercising different parts of your brain. So if, I'm gonna just compare it to like walking down a path on a hike, but this think of this as blood flow to the brain. If you're like walking down a path and there's like something in the way, it's creating another path that you can go down. Right. So, wait, I feel like there's something I've forgotten. No. We've talked a little bit about prognosis, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, in saying that, I've already said there's nothing you can do about genetics. You know, you're stuck with that. There's nothing you can do about aging. You're stuck with that. Here are the things you can control. Here are the strategies. And there's our mantra down there. What is good for the heart is good for the brain. Keep on reminding yourself of that. You know, a lot of people do these brain exercises, you know, the ones where you go on like the computer and you play the games. That's fine to do. That's fine to do. But if your choice is between going on a walk and doing that, going on a walk is better for your brain, hands down, without a doubt. Okay, so lifestyle strategies. Number one is exercise. We'll talk a little more about each of these strategies. A heart healthy diet. Again, what's good for the heart is good for the brain. Managing your numbers, your weight, your blood pressure, diabetes, and depression. Reducing your stress, good for the brain. Surprise, surprise. And quitting smoking. We're not going to go into that one because I think that one is, you know, you do it or you don't. Okay, so exercise. For the brain, the aerobic exercise is key. So the aerobic exercise means getting the blood pumping, getting the oxygen flowing, okay? Here are all of the bonuses. It reduces stress, blood pressure. It increases your blood flow to your brain. As you're exercising, your heart is pumping faster and faster, and it's getting more blood going to your brain. And so doing that pretty consistently is great for your brain. It's feeding your brain more nutrients, more oxygen. The important thing about exercise, important number two, is doing something that you're gonna keep on doing, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know whether anybody in this room has started up an exercise regimen, given themselves maybe a little too much to do, a little too much too fast, and then you're like, ugh, I can't do this, failure, right? Geriatricians say this with both exercise and medicine, which is start low and go slow. So start with what you know that you can achieve so that you won't fail, because failure discourages us. You don't want to fail at this. So even if it's exercising for 5 minutes where you wouldn't have, even if it's when you're like sitting there watching TV and just like doing some of these, that's better than not doing anything at all. And then you can congratulate yourself for your achievement and move on to the next level.
But not go for the ice cream.
No, because that exercise, let me repeat this exercise for you again. Besides, ice cream is therapeutic sometimes.
Stress.
I like that.
But I'm gonna show you this exercise again. See, I'm not walking to the fridge, not walking to the freezer. I'm just going up and down. So here, those are some ideas of good dancing. Oh, such great aerobic exercise, but it also makes you feel good in so many ways if you like to do it, if you don't like to do it. I'm speaking for myself, but you know, it's often a social activity. You can throw caution to the wind. Who cares if you look awful when you're dancing, as long as you're doing it? Yeah.
I do a move to music class.
Yeah.
I'm a SASH program coordinator.
Oh, great.
And the move to music is by far far my most popular class.
Yeah.
We get up and dance, and a lot of people, when we first started, it's like could hardly do anything, and now, you know, there's a lot more.
Where is your program?
It's in Randall.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And sometimes, and what I keep telling my folks I work with too, it's like, just put music on instead of the TV, or if you have a station on your TV that has music, start your day with that.
Yeah, dance party.
Before you know it, you're moving around the house, feeling more energized, and your depression lessens, and it feels good.
It does feel good. And then yoga. Yoga is great for stretching, moving your body. Gardening, who would have thought? You know, this is something people love to do naturally, but it really does get your body moving. Have you ever hoed a garden? That is really, that is aerobic exercise. Walking is great, and everybody can walk, right? I digress, not everybody, but swimming. Oh, speaking of swimming, if you're kind of local to here, there's a free Friday at the Aquatic Center, which is 9 to 11 a.m. on Fridays, and there's an aerobic water class in there that if you can get there at that time, it's free.
Along with yoga, it's not exercise, but meditation is often mentioned, the stress stuff here too. It's not aerobic? Oh.
We'll get there. Okay, so in terms of diet, talk to your doctor about the best diet for you to manage those numbers, right? Because managing the numbers is very important to these modifiable lifestyle strategies. So managing your blood pressure, managing your weight, your cholesterol, your diabetes. That's step number one when you think about diet. And then thinking about what is a heart-healthy diet. When you think about a heart-healthy diet, rich in antioxidants, the really colorful fruits and vegetables. The leafy greens, those things are full of good stuff. And if you absolutely hate the taste of those greens, and you hate the texture of those greens, get yourself a blender. Because you can make them taste so good.
Yeah, add ice cream.
There's a theme of the day. I think we're all too hot here. But I'm not kidding. You can hide the taste and the texture of kale. I get my toddler to eat kale this way by putting it in a blender with some delicious fruit. you hear the omega-3 and 6 fatty acids. That kind of helps with the synaptic activity in the brain. So you can get that through a lot of different fish, flax seeds, a lot of the different seeds too, like grape seeds, and nuts. You don't just like eat them, there's oil that you can get. Avocados, again, those green leafies, they're great for you. A couple diets that are really specific to this, there's some evidence behind the Mediterranean diet linked to brain health. The Mediterranean diet has a lot of clout, and we actually teach a class here on Mediterranean diet. So high consumption, it's always about like the fruits and the vegetables, by the way, have you noticed? Mm-hmm. So high consumption of vegetables, fruits, legumes, and cereals. Your predominant fat is olive oil, so rather than cooking with butter or canola or any other type of oil, using olive oil. Some fish, but not very much meat or poultry.
What's a low meat?
It means not very much. Yeah. Not very much dairy and then, you know, a little bit of dairy, not very much, and then maybe a little bit of wine. Yeah.
Does saturated fat have any effect on Alzheimer's prevention or something like that? Because there have been a lot of talk going on right now, Alzheimer's disease. I mean, saturated fat. Mm-hmm. They used to say don't eat it. Now they're coming back and saying you should eat it.
Yeah, so no, I haven't seen any connection made between the two, but I mean, it could just be that I haven't seen that specific research. There's a lot of research out there. But yeah, saturated fat is one of those things that it's, you know, at what time in life you've looked at it, what year has it been looked at, it gets a good rap or a bad rap. Not sure. I'm not sure how it's connected.
Have there been studies done that you're aware of about computer use and Alzheimer's connection or cell phones?
How specifically?
Like the energy EMFs.
Not that I've heard of. Nothing. But, you know, I could always, if you contact me with that specific question, we have access to some really good journals here, so I could look it up for you. And then there's the DASH diet, which I'm sure some of you have heard of. And this one is more about managing your blood pressure, which again, that's part of it, right? So lowering your sodium consumption. So thinking about how much salt is in things. High consumption of vegetables, once again, and fruits. And that is 4 to 5 servings of vegetables a day plus 4 to 5 servings of fruit per day.
Whoa.
Well, if you look at what a serving is, we have, I think we probably still have them, these books that it actually shows picture diagrams of what a serving is, and it's really not that much. It's like half an orange or something, or like, you know, 10 grapes. So.
Vegetables, it's half a cup.
Yeah,
except for spinach, it's a cup.
Ooh. a cup of dry. I mean, not cooked.
Uncooked
spinach. Yeah. So half a cup of your veggies is a serving. Thank you, Marie.
I think I misspoke on the spinach. I think it's cooked.
Oh, okay. Whole grains, a low-fat dairy. So dairy's okay. Just keep it low-fat. And
ice
then,
sorry?
A little
fat ice cream?
I guess so.
frozen yogurt, you know?
I like frozen yogurt.
Yeah. Moderate consumption. So these are all just like real foods, right? Real foods with fruits and veggies up high in there. I think that's sort of the word of the day, is thinking about your fruits and your veggie consumption and limiting your, unfortunately, it does say limited fats, oils, and sweets, which sounds an awful lot like ice cream. Okay, so then another lifestyle activity strategy here is staying engaged. And what do we mean by that? Well, it means social engagement and cognitive engagement, and actually those two kind of go hand in hand. So being socially active, that always leads to mental engagement. If you're in a social situation, well, I'll speak for myself, but I think this is common for most people. If you're in a social situation, you're being very social, you come home mentally tired, right? it is engaging. It's engaging to talk to people, just to be with people. And it makes for a healthier brain. It reduces stress. So just, we're social creatures. Isolation usually creates some stress. And getting with people, it's just an endorphin releaser. You get with people and your stress is reduced. And then there's some like therapeutic ways to reduce stress that way too. If you have certain stresses in your life and you're in like a support group or something, That can be a huge stress relief, just talking to people in the same situation as you. Overall quality of life is usually better. And this is the cognitive and reserve piece. Okay, so mental engagement. A lot of people will do something like crossword puzzles to make themselves sharper, right? That is gonna make you really, really good at doing crossword puzzles, right? But maybe a bigger challenge is something that's actually challenging to you, right? So if you've gotten really, really good at crossword puzzles, that's fine just to do as a leisure activity, but learning something new. Learning a musical instrument is a really, that's a top choice. But it also should be something that's like fun and not like you hate doing it. Same thing with exercise, right? So you want to be doing this thing that you chose to do. I'm going over a little bit, huh, on time? So that is, the learning piece is really important here. Learning new things and whatever's fun for you. Lowering stress. So we already talked about exercise lowers stress, social support lowers stress. The relaxation techniques. So there's meditation, lowers stress. Mindfulness is sort of all the rage right now, and there are a lot of opportunities for mindfulness practice around here. We happen to have an introductory class here at the Aging Resource Center, which always has a waiting list, but be patient and you'll get in if you want to. And then we also have like upkeep classes where you can practice mindfulness. And you can do it, there are also like websites that you can go to and you can learn to practice mindfulness. And there are a lot of other relaxation techniques that you can learn. Again, lowering your stress. If you're in a situation where you're, for example, providing care to somebody and it's really stressful, tough on you, take advantage of support groups. Don't be afraid of that because it can lower your stress so much. Seek out respite care so that you can have some time for you. And then do things that you enjoy doing. I know so many people that even in retirement, they like bog themselves down with all these activities that they hate doing. They like give themselves all these obligations. Rather than doing that, do things that for yourself and, you know, things that make you feel good. It lowering stress tremendously. And there you go. That's the summary for you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
Rebecca, several months ago, I read an article, I think it was in the Wellness Letter, memory loss. But it was an interesting comment by, I guess, a doctor who wrote the article about this whole memory loss issue that we talked about today. And it mentioned that, you know how you stated that there were, I don't know, 5 million people or so. And they said that is incredibly more significant than it was, say, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. And the fact is we're living longer, fitness and nutrition. Because of that, they said the medical professions feel they really have to put a lot more emphasis on the medical technology, because, you know, our medical technology has been incredible in our lives. And they said they're putting a lot of emphasis on starting to do a